So this is the first full week of our 1 Corinthians series that Josiah started last week. And if you weren't here for that, I do recommend listening to what he said about why we're doing this. And also, there was a super good little video that gives you sort of like the big picture of the whole book and where we'll be going with that. And so today we are appropriately going to start in chapter 1, as you heard from Hannah, verses 1 through 17. And so we'll start with the greeting, but before I get too far into that, I wanted to talk just a little bit more about the Apostle Paul's connection to this church, like what that relationship was and what the background was to him writing this letter. So we know most of this from Acts 18, which describes Paul coming to Corinth from Athens. And he stays there for about a year and a half. And while he's there, he's a tent maker, and so he's doing his tent maker stuff. And he lives with Priscilla and Aquila, who are also tent makers. And they're a married couple who seem to also already be Christians by the time Paul arrives, because there's never any discussion of like Paul converting them. And so just as an aside, those two are super interesting because Priscilla is the wife and she's almost always listed first, which is like the place of honor. And the New Testament describes her as like teaching and being very knowledgeable and teaching other prominent Christians like Apollos, who will show up in this passage that we're looking at today. And so some people have even theorized that either Priscilla alone or maybe Priscilla and Aquila wrote the book of Hebrews because it doesn't have a named author, though that is speculative because there's no named author. So Paul shows up in Corinth and he starts teaching in the synagogue. He starts teaching to the local Jewish population there. And a few people do convert, but for the most part, they're really not happy about that and they kick him out. And he says, fine, I'll go talk to the Gentiles instead. So he does that, but some Jews are in Corinth are still not happy with that. They not only want him not teaching them, they just want him like gone altogether. And so they drag him down before the Roman ruler in the city, whose name was Gallio. And Gallio is really not interested in their dispute and says, like, I'm not adjudicating your theology fights for you. Just please leave me alone. And so then there's like a crowd of mostly Gentile Corinthians who are there to like watch this all go down. And they turn on one of the like the main Jewish synagogue guy who was there to try to get Paul in trouble. And they beat him and Gallio doesn't care. So after that all happens, the church in Corinth gets well established, and then Paul moves on, and he leaves Corinth and he takes Priscilla and Aquila with him. And then after he's gone, he starts to get reports that things are not going so well in Corinth, that they are having all sorts of problems in their church, lots and lots of problems that we'll see over the course of the next many weeks. And so first he writes them a letter to try to deal with this, and that is not this letter. There's a letter before 1 Corinthians that we don't have, it didn't survive, but he references it in this letter and says, like, in my previous note, I said such and such. So first letter doesn't work. Then he writes this second letter in response to new reports, more questions from them. Doesn't work in the sense that they're not changing their behavior and they're starting to like reject his authority as an apostle and a teacher, even though he's the whole reason why they have a church in the first place. So then he writes a third letter, and this is his very stern letter. We also don't have this one, but it's like real harsh, and that one turns things around and they are willing to listen to him again. And in between the 1 Corinthians, what we have, and the very stern letter, he visits them and it goes really badly. So then he writes the stern letter, things get better, then he writes what we now have as 2 Corinthians, which is his fourth letter, which is a much more pleasant letter, things have changed, they're willing to listen to him again. And then after that, he makes a final visit to Corinth before he is executed, and they reconcile and things are good again. So I mentioned all that general background, partially just to get an idea of who's talking to who here, and also because the synagogue leader who gets beaten when he's there is named Sosthenes. So we don't know for sure if it's the guy mentioned in chapter or verse 1 here, but it seems probable because it's a well-known guy in the same city. And so he apparently has converted to Christianity at this point and is now with Paul in some other place writing back to his home church. So Paul mentions him to just establish that connection and remind them, the church, of their relationship. And, you know, that Paul has been there and they've hung out a lot. So then he briefly mentions his authority as an apostle. This is pretty short compared to how long he will talk about it in some of the other epistles. In Galatians, for example, Paul talks about, like, his calling and authority as an apostle for, like, a chapter and a half. So this one line is very brief by Paul's standards. But he does mention it, possibly because at this point they may already be beginning to doubt his authority, and so he wants to get that in there and remind them just of his background with Christ and with them. So his greeting here is pretty normal for the era, identifying both the author and the recipients, and it's pretty brief and basic. But there are a couple interesting and deliberate things he does. One is that secular letters in this time would often begin by praising the city where the recipients live, if it was at all noteworthy. And Corinth isn't a super big deal, but it's not nothing. It's like a Roman colony, and it's certainly not like a backwater. But Paul never talks about Corinth at all. He only talks about the people who live there, which suggests that he's identifying them not so much as Corinthians, but as Christians, and saying, like, just from the very beginning, this is the more important piece of identity for you. And likewise, when he uses the term Lord for Jesus, that's going to further separate these Corinthians from their neighbors who would have held Caesar as Lord, because to say Jesus is Lord is to say Caesar is not. So from the very beginning, Paul is tying his readers, well, hearers, life and identity to Christ. The second deliberate thing that he does, even in this basic hello, is he starts to point toward some of his bigger themes that will be upcoming. He mentions sanctification, which is basically just the process of becoming holy or becoming more like Jesus. It's a synonym we use transformation here more often, but it's sort of the same process. So he mentions sanctification, and he mentions unity, talking about the church in the singular and talking about, like, all the Christians, like the church universal. Even though there probably would have been multiple small house churches in Corinth, he talks about them all as one body. And that's notable because he's writing to a church that is very much not transformed, very much not sanctified, and very much not unified, but he's still speaking to them in this tone, sort of pointing towards what he's going to be talking about soon. And then third, he's writing to a church with both Jews and Gentiles, and so he greets them accordingly. He says peace, because that's a common Jewish greeting, and he says grace, that's a common Gentile greeting, and he's just getting everybody in there. So then he moves on to the thanksgiving, which again is pretty short by Paul's standards, because he's eager to get into this letter. He has many bones to pick with this church, but again, there's some preview of upcoming themes here when he talks about the grace given to them and the spiritual gifts. That's the same language as he's going to talk about spiritual gifts at length later in the letter, and likewise when he talks about enrichment with gifts of speaking and knowledge, that alludes to, like, gifts of preaching and teaching and prophecy that he'll talk about. And this idea of waiting for Jesus to be revealed, that points towards, he's going to talk a lot about resurrection towards the very end of the book, is kind of like the crowning moment of the letter. But the big thing to notice here is that even though there are a whole lot of problems in this church, and Paul is not sparing as he addressed them, he is frequently angry and sarcastic in this letter. It's a pretty big deal what's going on with them. He still begins by expressing this confidence in their salvation and in God's faithfulness to preserve it. So the problem here is not that the Corinthians are not really Christians, even though they are terrible Christians. They are Christians. And yet, despite how terrible they are, Paul is still always thanking God and always confident in what God is doing through them and in them. And this is not like a passive-aggressive Minnesota thing of, like, you know, you could look so nice if you did your hair better. Like, Paul is sincerely thanking God for what is happening with these people, as much as there's so much to correct. And so immaturity does not mean that they're not gifted, and it doesn't mean that they can't already be serving God and serving each other, even though they have such a serious need for transformation. So after this, he moves on to his first subject, which is division in the church, and this is where we're really getting into the body of the letter. So Paul has found out that the church at Corinth is very divided, and they're rallying around different human leaders, Paul himself, and then Apollos, and then Cephas, which is Peter. At least Paul and Apollos had come to town personally, and Peter may have as well. And then some people are in like a Christ faction, which we'll come back to that because that's pretty interesting. So the word for divisions here has a political connotation. It's like rival factions or parties, which suggests that this is not just like sincere, honest, good faith disagreement about what to believe or how to do church. Like this is, there's a power play element of it. They're politicking with each other. It's division in a pretty negative sense. And so we don't know for certain why they were divided. There's a lot of possible factors that Paul doesn't really spell out. One option is theological differences, like Peter and Paul, for example, had disagreed over Jewish and Gentile relations and behavior in the church. And even though they personally had settled that at this point, it was still a pretty common disagreement in the early church. So that's a possibility. It could be style differences. Apollos was known as a better speaker than Paul. Paul regularly says he's not very impressive in person and not very eloquent. It could be class divisions. We find out later in the book that they're having some division along economic lines, and even when they're taking communion, like the rich people are not giving the poor people stuff to take communion with. It could be ethnic divisions. Again, there's both Jews and Gentiles here. And that would also fit with some of the controversy he addresses later about can you eat meat that's been sacrificed to pagan gods that the Gentile Corinthians are worshiping. It could be a misunderstanding about baptism. The second part of this passage that we'll see on the next slide makes it sound as if perhaps they were seeing baptism as a sort of magic ceremony where that's what actually saves you, like the physical act of getting wet. And so in that case, you maybe would fixate on the person who baptized you, because if that's like what really saves you, then that person is like hugely important for you. And then it's possible that it's just like the house churches fighting among themselves because they had different groups in different parts of the city, and they probably very rarely, if at all, would have all gotten together in one place because they wouldn't necessarily have had a convenient room or place for that. So it seems like the splits may have begun and then solidified for multiple reasons, like you start fighting over one thing and then you find out they also disagree with you on that, so obviously you can't reconcile. But I think the fact that we don't know exactly why they're fighting has some advantages for us 2,000 years later, because it makes it harder to say, like, oh, what Paul said about unity applies to them and their situation, but our situation is so much more complicated and important that we can't be bound by that. So hearing about it in general terms, I think, is good for us because it doesn't let us sort of squirm out of it and try not to apply it to ourselves. And then finally, the Christ faction is interesting because you'd think they would be like the good ones who didn't line up behind any human leader, but Paul does not have any praise for them, which I think he would if that was what was going on. So it seems more likely that they've maybe put Jesus on the same level as other human, as like Paul and Peter and Apollos, and they're maybe not properly recognizing his divinity, or they're maybe putting his teachings like somehow in competition with the others. And so obviously Paul is very much not okay with that. So faced with these divisions, Paul is issuing a command for unity in Christ. And he'll return to this again in several chapters, so we'll hear more about that in a few weeks down the line. And so for now, I just want to hit on a few points of what Paul means when he calls for unity. The first thing is, though, that even though he does use very dramatic language, talking about everyone being of one mind and there being perfectly united in mind and thought, he's asking for unity, not homogeneity. So he never picks a faction and says, like, these guys are most right, they are believing the most right things, you should try to be more like this. In fact, even though presumably he thought his own theology was maybe more right than Peter or Apollos, where he differed from them, he doesn't say, like, look, I'm right on this, they're wrong, you need to just all rally around this. And later in the letter, he spends a lot of time talking about how Christians bring different things to the table using the famous metaphor of the body of Christ, where like the hand and the stomach and the foot all do very different things, and their difference and their ability to work together is an asset and a valuable thing, and you wouldn't want them to all be the same. And then second, when Paul talks about unity, it's always about unity in Christ, where Jesus is the focal point of our unity. And so this picture that I have up here is from the video that Josias played last week, which illustrates it well, I think, because the people in the circle are standing in different places, so they have different perspectives when they're looking at Jesus, but he's what unites them despite those differences. Everything is focused on Christ, and so that unity makes our differences an asset rather than a source of division. So Paul is not saying that we have to all be alike, but he is saying that disunity distracts and detracts from service to Jesus, and so we have to be one of one mind in our focus on Christ. And then in that final verse, just to call your attention to that, where Paul starts to talk about wisdom and elegance of language, that's going to move into his first big argument that Chris and John will talk about in the next 2 weeks, I believe. So some implications for us here, not in Corinth. The first one is Paul's personal example of humility and cultural flexibility. This is like classic Paul. He's always willing to adapt all the non-essentials, however is possible, to make his message most appealing and most intelligible to whoever he's talking to. And so, like in the greeting, when he uses both grace and peace, even though grace would have not been his cultural preference, he's going to say both because he's talking to people from both camps and he wants to reach both of them equally. And then likewise, when he starts talking about divisions in the church, notice that he uses himself as the prime example of a leader not to get hung up on. He's glad that he didn't baptize that many people because he doesn't want them to fixate on him. So that's just a good example to always be following, especially like Paul, when we're in a multicultural context like this, to be willing to be flexible and humble on those things that really don't matter that much. The second thing is that transformation or sanctification is a lifelong process, and so we can't wait until we've completed it to start exercising our spiritual gifts. Paul was already thankful for the good things that God was doing in and through this super, super messed up church. And it doesn't mean that transformation doesn't need to happen. He's about to write this whole letter about how badly they need to be transformed, but he's still confident that God is doing stuff through them right now. And if they put off exercising their spiritual gifts, if they put off that service to God while waiting to be transformed, then ironically, they probably never would be, because a lot of that transformation happens in that process. The third thing is a warning against interchurch cliques and politicking. As Josias mentioned last week, I don't think that we have a whole lot of this at Third Way. Maybe I'm missing it. I'm sure the church at Corinth also never expected that they would be in such a poisonous situation. And so no matter how good your theology or your practice of community can be, it's always possible for divisions to arise. And so it's good to be aware and proactive of that possibility before it happens, and just avoid moving into that sort of dysfunction. Plus, we have house churches too, so maybe that's just like ripe for division. And then finally, I think there's a warning against Christian tribalism on a larger scale, especially now that we have all these Christian celebrity pastors and authors that we read and follow and like often use to some extent to identify ourselves. Like if you're talking with someone about theology for the first time and they're trying to get an idea of where you stand, you might say like, oh, I like Greg Boyd, I agree with him on a lot of stuff, and that's fine. And it's not necessarily bad. It's liking a pastor or an author a lot is not the same as the division that was going on in Corinth, but I think it can become that. It can shift into something more negative where, like, I'm in this camp and the people who are not in this camp are maybe not good Christians or maybe not really Christians at all. And so the way to prevent that now is the same as what Paul said then, which is staying centered on Christ. We won't all think or act the same way, and we certainly won't all be gifted the same way, but we're all focused on Jesus so we can function as his body in this world. And that is all I have for you all today. Thank you.